This is The Takeout.
Ask not what your country can do for you.
With Major Garrett.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
At this defining moment, change has come to America.
And we will make America great again.
Welcome to the very best part of my broadcast week. I'm Major Garrett, Chief White House Correspondent for CBS News, but you already knew that. I'm joined, as I am every week on the Takeout Podcast, by the world's greatest podcast sidekick, the political director of CBS News, Steve Shigaris. Hello, Steve.
Hello, Major.
Happy sounds you hear around us. Nopa Restaurant. In the Penn Quarter of Washington, D.C., we've been here before. We're delighted to be back here again. And at the microphones, I'll tell you, we have special guests on this program all the time. Very, very special guest today. William Cohen, former Defense Secretary, former United States Senator from the great state of Maine, former member of the House of Representatives. It's fair to say a historic career in the United States Congress, dating back to the impeachment of Richard Nixon. Significant endeavors, both investigatory and legislative, in the United States Senate, and then was the first Republican ever to work as a defense secretary for a Democratic president of this great country, for Bill Clinton. William Cohen, thank you so much for joining us. Welcome to the Takeout Podcast microphones.
There's only one thing you left out of that bio. I was the mayor of the third largest city in Maine.
There you go. Which was?
Bangor, Maine.
Bangor, Maine.
Right. Now, I hesitate to point out, population 38,000.
Now, what's the proper Maine pronunciation of Bangor?
Bangor.
Bangor. Okay, not Banga or no. Something. Okay.
That's how they say it in Massachusetts, I think.
That's right, that other state, right? Yeah. Like other Commonwealth. It's great to have you with us, Mr. Secretary, Senator, Bill. All those will apply. We're going to talk about a lot of topics. You have a great deal of expertise in national security and international relations. We're going to get to North Korea in a minute, but it would be remiss of myself and Steve this week in American political life not to discuss the president's extraordinary press conference in the lobby of Trump Tower this week discussing the events in Charlottesville, Virginia. We have a soundbite I'd like you to listen to, and then we'll have a conversation. Katiana, please, soundbite number one.
Well, I do think there's blame, yes. I think there's blame on both sides. You look at both sides. I think there's blame on both sides, and I have no doubt about it, and you don't have any doubt about it either. And if you reported it accurately, you would say.
They showed up in Charlottesville to protest.
And you had some very bad people in that group. But you also had people that were very fine people on both sides.
Mr. Cohen, Bill, Senator, Secretary, you've been involved in public life a very long time. What is your general impression of what you heard yesterday, and what do you think its long-term political ramifications will be for this president?
I've tried to find the right words to respond to what I heard yesterday, and I've tried to be as modest as I can in my use of my language, not modest but moderate. It was disheartening to hear the president not distinguish between those who are holding up the flag of Hitler, who are calling for the displacement of Jews, to see the president fail to distinguish the level of hate that is being promoted by those who are carrying those flags and arguing for an all-white society, an all-white America. The president is fond of saying that the media is the enemy of the state. I feel that those people who hold up the flag of Hitler, who parade around with a swastika, those are the enemies of the state. That is totally anti-American. That is against everything we believe in. And we always hear if an African-American speaks out, they say, if you don't like the way we do things, by the way, that's a line in my wife's play, go back to Africa. Well, I would say to those who are raising Hitler's flag, go back to Germany, except Germany wouldn't have them.
They wouldn't have them.
They'd be in jail in Germany. And so this whole notion that they are celebrating something that the German people to this day prosecute people for saying the Holocaust was a hoax, for condemning Jewish people, for condemning blacks, they would not find a home in Germany. They would find themselves in prison. And so it's very discouraging to have the president fail to distinguish between those who are carrying torches, and those torches are symbolic. Years ago, the 20s, 40s, they were wearing hoods and carrying the torches. They were burning black churches carrying those torches. And so the
lynching African Americans.
Lynching, setting churches on fire with African Americans trapped inside. When you talk about lynching, they were not only hanging them, they were cutting off their body parts. They were setting them on fire as if it was a barbecue. So this has been a part of our country from the beginning. That's where racism takes us back to the very beginning. The country was founded in terms of bringing slaves to America to make America prosperous. And these are the folks who want to go back to that. And there is no turning back to that. And I would hope the president would have spoken out very clearly, not looking to equate the two. Saying that you're against violence is one thing, but the fact is that the anti-fascists have a higher moral plane than those who are pro-Hitler. In any event, I failed to hear the president really speak with any sincerity about the death of that young, beautiful girl. And to hear the organizers of the Nazis say, well, she got out of the way. She should have gotten out of the way. It's her fault. Or to hear one of the spokesmen say about President Trump, I'm more racist than he is because I never would have handed my daughter over to a Jew. These kinds of statements that are being allowed to be propagated and not condemned vocally with great sincerity by the president, I think, is going to continue to divide this country, is going to continue to radicalize much of the country because we worry about homegrown terrorists. Well, they're not all Muslims that are homegrown. There are white people who are white terrorists in our country. And if we keep dividing our people based upon racial or ethnic or religious lines, we're going to have a divided country which will undermine our national security. So when you talk about homegrown terrorism, start looking at white terrorism and calling it for what it is.
When you were in the Senate, you had a reputation, as did many of your colleagues, of being a student of history. When you see the kind of language you just described gaining a kind of traction that it never had, that it hasn't had recently, it would be a misnomer to say it never had it. It had traction in this country for many, many decades. But that has changed in the last 30 to 40 years, and it was a hard process to move from traction to no traction. But when you see it attempting to regain, and in some cases regaining traction, what do you think of the long-term dangers of that?
I think the long-term dangers are that this is going to continue. The goal is for them, as Dylan Roof said, to start a race war. I think that is their goal. Get rid of all black people. Get rid of all Jews.
The convicted shooter at Mother Emanuel Church in Charleston, South Carolina.
And this is not new. This has always been there. This is the history of this country. So to say this is not America, this has been a part of America from the beginning.
The malignancy of slavery.
Malignancy is slavery. Then you go from, okay, now we have emancipation, now we have Reconstruction. No.
Black codes.
Now we're going to go back and undermine Reconstruction.
Jim Crow laws.
And Jim Crow. So this has been with us a long time. It's not new. What's happened is the people out there who have been in hiding, so to speak, or in anonymity on the Internet, they now feel free to come out, take off the hoods, and they can walk down the street carrying those flags, adoring Hitler. Because they feel they've got a friend. They feel they've got a friend in the White House.
I want to ask you, what do you think it says about this president that days after a tragedy like this in Charlottesville, that he is really sort of fanning the flames of a political debate as opposed to trying to unify the country?
Well, I keep hoping that the president will, quote, act presidential. I did not support him during this past election. I made it very clear. I thought by temperament he was not qualified to serve in that high office. I keep hoping that he will understand the gravity of that office, that every word counts, that when he makes a statement, he must weigh those words carefully for their consequence to people all over the world. I still wait for that. I am pleased, frankly, that he has Jim Mattis, Secretary Jim Mattis at DOD. I am pleased that he's got General McMaster and Kelly. But they're They're holding fort. They're trying to steer him on a course of responsibility. And the time that I least believe he's sincere is when he's reading. It's when he goes off script.
Like this Trump Tower press conference.
Yes, that's when you see the real Trump. That's the real person. He says these things in private, no doubt. He thinks these things in private. And when he goes off script, that's the real Donald Trump, and that's what's most troubling. When he's reading something, his heart's not in it. He's saying, well, okay, I've got to read this, I've got to say this, but it's not something that I really am committed to. I would think that he would want to be committed now when he sees what these people are saying about his daughter, about his son-in-law, about his key advisors, whether it's Treasury or Economic Council. These are Jewish people who are advising him, and they're saying, get rid of them. No Jews. We're not going to let you displace us. Pretty horrific stuff, and he hasn't spoken out against that.
Just to lighten things up, if possible, we're at Nopah Restaurant, a wonderful restaurant here in the Penn Quarter of Washington, D.C. It's lunchtime, and as always, Mr. Secretary, I'm always hungry. I'm just perpetually hungry. So I'm going to start off the ordering parade. I saw on the menu the brisket and short rib melt, which looks to me like bread and a lot of cheese and a lot of very juicy meat. So bring me one of those, if you'd be so kind. Shigeris, what are you going to do?
I'm getting the burger.
Okay.
Cooked medium.
Medium plus. Simple. Actually, right?
No, just medium, Major. Right. We'll have that discussion later.
Mr. Secretary, what can we get you for lunch? A recoil from the Secretary, the buzz sound.
I'm going to defer lunch until after I conclude this.
See, Bill Cohen, for those of us who covered him in the Senate, I didn't have the pleasure of covering you as Defense Secretary, but I covered you in the Senate. Always incredibly well put together, always well organized, dress-wise and in presentation. He's not going to muck around with food and anything the way I do. So we respect that, Mr. Secretary.
Yeah, thank you.
The lunch is coming to you after the podcast. Before we go to break, I want to play, because I want to transition from this conversation we've had, because you could not have been more clear. Because those around the president, this particular president, are very, very important. And you mentioned Defense Secretary James Mattis. That is a job you once held. I want to play for our audience, Katiana, if you'd be so kind, clip number 9, because this was what you said about James Mattis at his confirmation hearing January 12th, 2017.
They talk about the tyranny of the inbox. Well, you have it. Tyranny in the inbox in the Pentagon, and things come at you with a velocity of a heat-seeking missile. And so you have to then look and say, how do I deal with this? Who is it who's making the decision? And in that case, I think you should take great confidence in this man who understands what it means to be in battle, and he understands what it means not to go into battle. And he has the love for his troops is returned in a way that I've not seen before. His troops, men and women alike in all services, love this man. And they love him because he loves them and what they do for our country, what they're willing to risk for our country.
A better testament, a more heartfelt and relevant testament, I don't think I've ever heard on behalf of someone nominated to be Defense Secretary of this great country, Secretary Cohen. And it, I think, if I may, illustrates a kind of dichotomy that many people in Washington are living through on a day-to-day basis. They look at the misgivings they have about the President of the United States, and then they look at people around him and say, these people around him have great qualifications, great attitude, great experience. And it seems like there's this collective hope that those appointed can bring this president to a better place.
Well, it's really quite ironic if you go back and look at President Trump's campaign. He said he favored waterboarding. He said he favored torture. He said that NATO was irrelevant or obsolete. He didn't support the EU, thought it was just one big irrelevant bureaucracy or burdensome bureaucracy. He felt that the Chinese were currency manipulators and he's going to impose a 20 or 40% tariff. I mean, the list is quite long. And then you had Jim Mattis, who a warrior of great renown, who said, no, I don't believe in waterboarding. I don't believe in torture. I believe that NATO is relevant. I believe the EU is important. And so you have a Secretary of Defense who's basically saying to the president, I don't support those issues, and I hope that you will not put me in a position of trying to implement any of those issues. And I think if the president ever did that, Jim Mattis would walk away in a nanosecond. So he's a man of great principle. He's a warrior who's been in war, who's had to hold bleeding soldiers, dying soldiers in his arms. The president
prefers one nickname, Mad Dog, but Jim Mattis prefers Warrior Monk.
Yeah, and I called him Braveheart. Warrior Monk is probably better.
And that's the one he actually prefers, as someone who's thought seriously about the art of being a warrior and the cost and risks of being a warrior.
Well, the reason that the soldiers, his soldiers in battle loved him is because he wasn't in the rear lines. He was up front with them. He was putting his life right alongside theirs during the course of battle. That's the warrior. The monk part is he's got about 7,000-8,000 books, and he's read, unlike most of us who have books, he's read them all. And so it always...
They're not there just for show.
Not just for show. He absorbs the lessons of history, and you can be sure if he ever recommends to the president that, yes, we have to go to war, that he's thought about the consequences of it. He's weighed the measure of treasure that will be lost and expended, both in blood and monetary terms. That's the reason I was able to say waive this restriction of not allowing generals who have not been out of office for 7 years. This man, we need him, and we need him badly.
That's the voice of William Cohen, Defense Secretary of the United States, former United States Senator, member of the United States Congress, a proud Mainer, and we are delighted and gratified to have you at the Takeout Podcast microphones. I'm with Steve Shigaris. This is Major Garrett. You probably already knew that, and you're listening to, because you love it, The Takeout.
You are listening to The Takeout.
Which means you're listening to your absolute favorite podcast. That's what you're doing. This is The Takeout. I'm Major Garrett, joined as I always am by Steve Shigaris, the world's greatest podcast sidekick. This is also a TV show on CBSN. We're so delighted to have that. 9 p.m. Eastern and Pacific, Friday and Saturday. Hello, CBSN. Takeout podcast stickers. You know, every member of the CBS Board of Directors has one of these.
Do they?
All of them.
If not, we can.
And many of them. Many of them have several. And I know they've adorned them on their computers, on their bumpers. They have them on the refrigerator. I'm told that some members of the CBS Board of Directors actually have them on their pillow.
Really?
Steve Shigaris, yeah.
Pillow?
William Cohen does not have
it on
his pillow.
It doesn't seem to be a practical use of a sticker.
Yes, but he is a member of the CBS Board of Directors. Full disclosure, that's important thing for this podcast to do. He's on the board of directors. He's also, as I've well established, a significant voice on lots of issues in lots of different important places in American politics. Steve Shigaris, the board of directors, they all know how they got their Takeout podcast stickers because they called me up and said, Major, what are you going to do? And I got
every
it to them straight
one, huh?
away. That's what happens when you're on
sticker?
The board.
Because right. if not, we can...
Yeah.
We'll hook you up.
But for our listeners and viewers who we cherish so dearly, how can they obtain said sticker signed by me? Okay?
There's only one way to do it. If you'd
one
like
way.
Your very own one Takeout way. Podcast sticker signed by Major Garrett, please send your request along with a self-addressed stamped envelope to Takeout Sticker, care of CBS News at 2020 M Street Northwest, Washington, D.C. 20036.
Excellent. We're going to talk about North Korea now. And I want to play for our audience something the president said just a week ago in Bedminster, New Jersey. That's cut number three. Katiana, please go ahead.
I think China can do a lot more, yes. China can. And I think China will do a lot more. Look, we have trade with China. We lose hundreds of billions of dollars a year on trade with China. They know how I feel. It's not going to continue like that. But if China helps us, I feel a lot differently toward trade. A lot differently.
That's China. Yes, I said we're going to be talking about North Korea. They are inextricably linked, as our guest, William Cohen, the former Defense Secretary, United States Senator, member of Congress, knows all too well. Help our audience, if you could, Mr. Secretary, understand the linkages between China and North Korea and how central it is or is not to a peaceful resolution of this ever-escalating conflict.
there can never be a peaceful solution or resolution of the situation on the Korean Peninsula without China. China is one of the major supporters of the North Koreans. I've said on many different outlets that the North Koreans have a guns and butter policy. They've been able to develop these missiles and weapons while enjoying the butter furnished by the Russians, the Chinese, and others in the region. The only way we can ever try to bring about a successful conclusion to their expansion, the North Koreans' expansion of their missile and technology program, is to force them to face the economic consequences of deprivation. And that means the Chinese would have to severely cut back the business they're doing with them. I'm not sure they're prepared to do it at this moment. But I've talked to the Chinese. I have two offices over there. I go there frequently. I talk to their top leadership.
In what capacity?
Just as a citizen.
Mm-hmm.
Because I have offices in Beijing, Tianjin. I have an office in Delhi. I have offices in the Middle East. So I talk to them and say, look, you have a reputation of being being a chess player, a grandmaster chess player. It's in your interest to make sure that violence doesn't break out on the peninsula. It's in your interest to see ultimately a unified Korea, because basically South Korea is one of their major trading partners. North Korea is a burden on their economy. So if you're looking at it strategically, wouldn't it be great if you had a unified Korea in which the United States would not pose any kind of a military challenge to the Chinese, but rather had a peaceful peninsula as such that was not militarized the way it is? They could then, the Korean people could be united, they could be prosperous, they could not present a threat to anybody in the region. That would be in China's long-term interest. Right now they see the threat of the United States being on their border if there were a united Korea under the circumstances where there were a...
Separated only by the Yalu River.
Right. So there's a way to resolve this, and I think the president is correct. I give him credit when he is correct that the Chinese have more to do. They can, in fact, squeeze the North Koreans to the point where they could almost break them. They're worried about the flux of people who would scatter to the north.
Refugees.
Refugees or military, and those scattering to the south as far as the South Koreans are concerned. So I've always tried to encourage, let's have a plan here. What happens? What happens if things go south? What do the Chinese do? What do we do? If we see millions of people coming over the DMZ heading to Seoul, are they refugees? Are they soldiers? Do they get shot at? Do they get welcomed? And the same thing for the Chinese. So this is potentially very volatile for both. So I think there's a deal to be made. I think the Chinese are the biggest players. I think the Russians are in this too, that we could work out these disagreements if we sat down and said, let's find a way to peacefully reunite the peninsula.
Steve Shigaris.
Can we talk a little bit about the war of words that happened over the last week between President Trump and Kim Jong-un? There was a lot of concern of what the president said, his fire and fury comments, and his continued comments afterwards, that potentially this is putting us on the brink of something. And then what wound up happening this week was what normally happens, it seems, with North Korea, which is they back off at the end of the day. I know it was a completely untraditional way of handling North mm-hmm. Korea, but in hindsight, what is your take on how the president handled all of this?
Well, he's president. I'm not. I would not have handled it this way. I would have handled it the way Jim Mattis handled it, in saying directly to the North Koreans, if you ever consider attacking the United States, our allies, our territories, you will be met with overwhelming response. Very direct message, no fire and brimstone, that's the message. What I don't want to see is the president engage in a kind of diplomatic trash talk. My guns are bigger than your guns. My bombs are better than your bombs, and we're going to destroy you and rain down.
Why not?
Why?
Because Trump supporters say that's what this has needed, because we've had all these diplomatic niceties for
five or six administrations,
and Kim Jong-un has to be spoken to in a way that he grips and he understands.
You cannot out-trash-talk Kim Jong-un. You just reduce yourself to his level. What you do is you say, keep talking that way. Meanwhile, we're telling the Chinese we're serious. I've said this publicly before, but Dr. Kissinger is called upon from time to time to give advice to the White House, the president. In Dr. Kissinger's White House years, he made a very, very important statement. He said, a bluff that is taken seriously can be helpful, but a serious threat that is taken as a bluff can be catastrophic. That same point was made by Dean Acheson when he was Secretary of State. Don't make a bluff that you're not prepared to carry out. Now, if the North Koreans think he's bluffing, they'll continue to up the ante. If the Chinese think he's bluffing, they will continue not to put enough pressure on. So if you say something, mean it. And if you say something like that, you better be prepared to carry it out. And I think that's the danger here. I think the Chinese have gotten to the North Koreans.
Were you worried at any point during this last week or so that North Korea was going to take this to another level? Because there were a lot of people that were very worried about Guam or the U.S. Or were you one of those people?
You can't tell. That's the when you can't calculate what Kim Jong-un is going to do, then you have to be on edge. Now, I took solace in the fact that Jim Mattis, once again, made a very strong statement. I took solace with Rex Tillerson, Secretary of State, saying, hey, calm down. Let's get this thing back on track. So I think the rhetoric may have impressed the Chinese. I don't think you can really scare the North Koreans. I think that they love to get in the bluffing game.
Was it important in this context when the Chinese said through the foreign ministry that if there is any attack from the North Koreans on Guam or any U.S. territory, it's on its own? Was that important?
Very important.
Tell us why.
Because the North Koreans, North Korea doesn't exist without the Chinese. So for the Chinese to say you're on your own and then cut back the economic support they have, that pretty much would stir, in my judgment, a rebellion from within. You would have a change of regime coming from within, which is a risk that the North Koreans are running right now.
That's the voice of William Cohen, former Defense Secretary of the United States of America, former United States Senator and member of the House. You are listening to The Takeout.
I think when it comes to Donald Trump, he uses language to divide, to demean, and ultimately to divert. He's diverting attention from the big issues, and it forces you and the media to be chasing everything down a rabbit hole. What did he mean? Was it sarcastic? Was it sincere? Was it Delphically ambiguous? How do we find out? And we go around.
Delphically ambiguous. We're going to get into Delphically ambiguous, ladies and gentlemen. Don't think we won't. I'm Major Garrett, the host of the Takeout Podcast, joined as I am every week by Steve Chigueras, the world's greatest podcast sidekick. Hello, Steve.
Hello, Major.
Political director of CBS News. That's the voice of William Cohen, former United States Senator, member of Congress, defense secretary, on a program you've probably heard of, Face the Nation, on the great CBS News Network. August 14th, 2016. So, this issue that you just identified, I can tell you, Secretary Cohen, having attended more than 75 Donald Trump for President rallies across our great country, people who supported Donald Trump hear you say that and say, I don't care. They say, through all of that, which they would not necessarily disagree with in toto, they would say in specific, he speaks to me about my life, what I feel concerned about, and he does it in a way that feels and sounds more authentic than anyone I've heard in 30 years. He's got a track record. He's not bought. He's not paid for. He's my guy. And because he's my guy and talks to me in a way I've never heard or haven't heard, I'm sticking with him. Mm-hmm. How do you take that at face value, do you not?
Oh, I do. I do. I think it's quite clear that...
That's why he is the 45th president of the United States.
That's why he is the 45th president, exactly. But I think the people who support him also have to understand that dividing the country as he is doing by his language and his use of pointing out people who are different as being less than Americans. For example, when he had during his rallies, if there were a person, a black person in the audience who demonstrated on the way out, a white person assaulted that individual, and he made statements basically, that's the way we do it, folks. Well, that's not the way we do it. That's not a sign of civilization. That's a sign of a barbarous type of society where you stifle voices of dissent in a democratic system by the use of force. So I think people have to get back to it and say, okay, we understand. He's speaking to the American people who feel, quote, alienated, who feel disrespected. But I have to wonder, where does all this victimhood come in? You know, white people, we have had 400 years of a head start, as D.H. Hughley said. We had 400 years head start. What are we complaining about? Is it because black people are displacing white people on these jobs? Are the Hispanics displacing people from their jobs? Is that the problem? Or do we celebrate our diversity? Take a look at this country. Just walk down the street. Coming through to this interview, I looked at all the people on the street. They were every hue, every race, every ethnicity.
Many different languages.
I don't know how many languages would be spoken. But this is a country that we celebrate. This is us, from many, one. And what's happening is we're turning that around. From one, we are becoming many. And that dispersion of this uniting spirit of what it means to be an American, I think, is being lost. And it's not to be found in raising a flame saying, let's make America white again. If that's what this is all about, making America white again, we're in deep trouble. And I say this because it's a national security issue, which my wife Janet has raised constantly, because if we're not united domestically, we're not going to be strong internationally. Other countries look at us. I travel the world every week virtually. And they look at us and they shake their heads. They can't believe what is happening here in terms of where...
Are they sad?
They're sad because they know that America is the one country that really has maintained peace and stability for the most part throughout this last century. And they know that whenever we're not there, other countries who don't have our best interests at heart are there. And they see that and they say, where are you? Give you a good example of that. I was in Singapore in June, and Secretary Mattis was giving a speech, the right speech about we're there, we're a Pacific power, we intend to keep navigation, freedom of navigation open, we're not going to allow anyone to interfere with that, etc. Right message. At the same time, the president was in Brussels, and he was pointing out, saying, NATO, you haven't kept your bargain here. What's this building? I'm not even asking you how much it costs. And by the way, in the speech itself, with the words, we reaffirm the Article 5 of the NATO Charter. You omitted it. Now, silence under those circumstances, when everybody was expecting him to say that, was heard all the way over in Singapore. And that carried in Singapore saying, well, who speaks for the president? Does Jim Mattis speak for him? Is the president didn't invoke Article 5 or say we affirm it?
And for our audience, quickly, Article 5 is the essence of the NATO Charter. Any attack on one member is met by resistance, armed resistance by every other member.
Right.
Just to solidify that, Steve.
Can I ask you about another war of words, another rabbit hole that we seem to have been chasing? Mitch McConnell and Donald Trump. So Trump has had some pretty harsh things to say about the Senate Majority Leader. This is a man that you served with. This is a man who was in leadership when you left the Senate. First of all, what is your take on how the president is dealing with that issue? Secondly, have you heard anything from Senator McConnell on all this? And how do you think this all affects the relationship between the president and Senate Republicans?
I think the president has failed to understand that Congress, both branches, are co-equal, that he has to work with them. And when you start either trying to intimidate, insult, or demean any member, be a House member or the majority leader in the Senate, you're going to undermine your presidency. He's creating hard feelings when he doesn't need to. He may feel poorly that Mitch was not able to get John McCain to vote with him. But he's going to need Mitch McConnell. He's going to need Republicans. And when you start criticizing individual members or threatening them, you're going to run people against them. That's going to make them reluctant to be your enthusiastic supporters. They may act out of fear and support you. They're not going to act with enthusiasm, and you may lose them on key issues in the future.
Do you think it threatens – so you think it threatens his agenda, first of all, and secondly, do you think it threatens the Senate majority, the Republicans' majority in the Senate?
Well, it could. I mean, would he rather have Mitch McConnell as the leader, or would he rather have the Democrats take over the Senate? How would he like that for the last 2 years of his first term? So, you know, presidents
with them having in committee chairmanships and investigatory and subpoena power.
Exactly.
How about that?
He would not like that. So it's real easy. You know, invite members down, make them feel important. I was very critical of Barack Obama. He did not have a good relationship with the Congress. And from Democrats who would criticize, saying they never see him, doesn't come, they don't get invited, calls don't come in. So I don't think he handled the Congress as well as he could have. Bill Clinton, by contrast, George W. Bush, by contrast, always invited people down. Come down, talk to me, have a bagel, if not a hamburger, and let's see if we can talk this thing out. President Obama was not inclined to do that. I think he suffered as a result of that. Mm-hmm. And President Trump, I think you start attacking the members.
Taking it to another level, perhaps.
Mr. Secretary, this is not a bagel, by the way. Let me say this right now. This is, we're at Nopah Restaurant, the Penn Quarter of Washington, D.C. This is my brisket and short rib melt, and it is spectacular in all of its grandiose messiness and deliciousness. Nopah, thank you very much. Shigaris doesn't eat on camera. That's his thing. I respect that, though.
Trying to spare our audience chewing into the microphone.
Only barely.
Watch out for that tie, though.
Mr. Secretary, I want to ask you about the Senate itself. I arrived in Washington, D.C. in 1990. I spent a lot of time covering the House of Representatives and the United States Senate in the early 1990s, and I don't want to be conspicuously nostalgic because sometimes nostalgia is not as helpful as we think it is. We feel it, but it's maybe not relevant. But I would argue, and I want to submit this to you, they were different chambers, distinctly different chambers in predilection, in practice, in orientation to their job. The House of Representatives prided itself on moving legislation, moving it through the Rules Committee and the majority with an iron will. The minority was afforded scant opportunities to influence and affect legislation. Then it came to the Senate. And the Senate organized itself around the idea that everyone was a potential titan, and everyone's voice could constructively and conceivably redirect legislation by the force of their intellect, the force of their rhetoric, and the force of their staff. And that sometimes was bipartisan, sometimes it was partisan, but it was a slower and more deliberative process that was closer to what the Senate conceived of itself, which was separate from the way the House conceived of itself. I feel now the Senate in so many ways resembles the inclinations of the House of Representatives, which is not what we created in this country.
Regrettably, the money chase has contributed to that. Senators work, let's say, from Tuesday to Thursday night, off by Friday into the campaign trail. And much of that campaign trail is raising money. And so the extraordinary amounts that have to be raised today, I think, contribute to this reduction of the Senate to being just another House with six-year terms. Fortunately, we still have Senate rules. In addition to the staff you mentioned and just the difference of the personalities, you have different rules. And the rules in the Senate were designed to slow things down, to make sure that the hot temper of the House, which is closest to the people, which it should be, gets cooled a bit to say, let's step back. Let's move back just a bit to see whether this is really what we want to do. So it's always been a balancing of the fiery temper of the House because you're passionate, you have 2 years to persuade your constituents you're doing the right thing. Senators always were, quote, at least statesmen for 4 years and then House members for two. Now they're all running all the time. And I think as a result of that, people look upon the House and the Senate as the same.
Indistinguishable.
Mm-hmm. And it's sad.
Before we end this podcast, at least this part of it, the president's called for an end of the rules you just indirectly referred to. And the rules are, if there is a conflict within the body, that a supermajority, not the super, super majority, but 60 votes is required to move something along. The president has said on Twitter repeatedly, Republicans are stupid, look dumb, and weak by not abolishing those rules and making a simple, harsh majority on every question that comes before the body. What's the danger of
that? The Senate rules were there to protect the minority. And the minority can one day become the majority. Mm-hmm. Just as we've had Democratic control in the past, you could have Democrats backing control, and they would have a majority rule without having the Republicans having to have any say in things. That's why you have in the House, you have the House Rules Committee. They say when a bill is going to come up, how long it's going to be debated, and a vote will take place. That's different in the Senate for a very important reason. The Senate is designed to slow things down so you don't have the tyranny of the majority. You protect the rights of the minority so that at least you come to some kind of a consensus whereby, all right, we've done our best. The majority is going to prevail here ultimately with 60 votes, but we have come to a consensus that can be supported in both houses.
That's the voice of William Cohen, former Secretary of Defense, former United States Senator, former member of the House of Representatives. Steve Shigaris, political director of CBS, thank you for joining
us. Thank you, Major.
As always, I think it's fair to say, among the best episodes of the Takeout podcast, thanks to you, Secretary.
Thank you very
Cohen.
Much. Appreciate
Episode
it.
31. I know you're keeping count at home. I'm Major Garrett. This has been The Takeout.
The Takeout is produced by Arden Farhi, Tatiana Krachenko, and CBS Radio News. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and visit takeoutpodcast.com for more information.
My food.
Ooh, that looks good.